Hello, welcome to Higginson Strategies Behind the Story, the podcast that goes beyond the headline. I'm Clodagh Higginson, and today we're asking, are we really facing an extinction crisis, as many scientists warn? And if so, what can we do about it? Sitting opposite me are my four guests, Zach Goldsmith, the Conservative MP and well-known environmentalist, Peter Hall of the International Rhino Foundation, Joanna Elliott from Fauna and Flora International, and Matthew Hatchwell from the Zoological Society of London. Welcome to you all. Okay, well, let's kick off with the most fundamental question. Are we, in fact, facing an extinction crisis to rival that which killed off the dinosaurs? Zach, if I could start with you, what's your view?
My view, very simply, is that the extinction crisis is already happening. It's not something we have to wait and see if the predictions are correct. It's already happening. Since my year of birth, we've lost nearly 60% of the world's wild animal population. We've seen that about a third of the world's oceans have been exhausted or on the point of exhaustion in terms of overfishing. We see about 18 million acres of forest removed every year. So this is already happening, and it is already a crisis, and it's already having a massive impact on human populations around the world, human populations that depend directly on the free services that nature provides, on the whole, the world's poorest people. So it's happening now. The question is, what does it take to wake up our leaders to the extent of the crisis? What does it take to stimulate the kind of action that we're going to need?
Well, yes, if all of the evidence is there and it's very stark, Peter, why do you think we're seeing such little action?
I think there's so many interest groups involved. There's no money. Unlike climate change, there's so much money going around that there's no economic interest. It's really an act of altruism and forethinking, of thinking for future generations. And we don't actually have a lot of political politicians focused on the long term. Most politicians and most interest groups are focused on short term and short term benefits.
Joanna, can I bring you in here? Before joining Fauna and Flora International, you used to work in government at the Department for International Development. Do you think that global nature gets the attention it deserves in Westminster?
Let me just add that from an FFI's point of view, I just want to add to the, in terms of an extinction crisis, just to broaden it out well beyond the charismatics. So FFI, as you can imagine, works a lot on fauna. We have seen, and on flora, we've seen this crash in vertebrate and invertebrate populations. So I just want to add, because I think this nuance around pollinators and agricultural systems is a terribly important one to bring in. So the fact that in Western Europe, in the last 20 years, we've seen an 80% loss of insects is actually incredibly dramatic. So just to add to Zach's points, the richness of these ecosystems, they're not just being stripped at the top, they're being stripped all the way down to the microbes in the soil.
But do you think that government is concentrating on so-called charismatic species?
So let me answer that question, sorry. So 20, 30 years ago, UK led the world in terms of really investing in integrated conservation and development responses. The UK was very much the originator of support for community-based conservancy systems terrestrially and in the marine space. A lot of other ways in which the UK was a global leader. The knowledge and expertise is still very much there, but biodiversity has slipped very significantly down the development agenda over the last 5 years. There are exceptions, I would say. I mean, noting particularly the Darwin Fund and research programmes like ESPA, which programmes have really brought together this wealth of British expertise, British knowledge, good NGO behaviour. But it is, I would totally agree with Peter and Zach, it is very underfunded.
Clodagh, if I can just make a point on that. In 2010, Britain spent £66 million on global biodiversity protection. It is now £44 million. So there's been a 33% reduction. And when you contrast that with the £14 billion that are spent on overseas development assistance, we are spending 0.3% on nature and biodiversity and 99.7% on human beings. And this is the fundamental point. There is a complete imbalance between what's spent on nature and what is spent on humanity.
And that also contrasts with the scale of investment in biodiversity conservation by other countries. Germany is the great example elsewhere in Europe, which is channeling €500 million a year into biodiversity conservation.
Even the United States is miles ahead of us. Norway, lots of countries. And we're actually, we're big in terms of international development. I think we're the world's second biggest donor. But we're miles behind in terms of how much of that goes towards nature, broadly speaking. And I think that's partly because there is this view that the two things are entirely separate. But it should be obvious to those people involved in trying to deal with issues around poverty that people cannot exist in a world denuded of nature. You know, you've got 1 billion people depend on forests directly for their livelihoods. You've got 1 billion people who depend on fish as their main source of protein. 200 million people depend on fish for their livelihoods. You wipe out the marine environment, wipe out the forest, you're wiping out livelihoods. And as ever, it is the people who are most dependent on those free services who are hit hardest, and they tend to be the poorest people. So there is this extraordinary blind spot in governments, not just our government, in governments, but also, I would say, in the development community, this pretense that you can somehow focus just on humans and ignore nature without that having an impact on humans. And that's the bit we need to get over. And if we don't, then I don't think we have a chance.
And talking of fish, Zach, you cited a figure of 60% for the drop in vertebrate populations since 1970. For freshwater ecosystems, that percentage is 80%.
It's extraordinary.
So and the impact of that on people living closest to nature, the people whose livelihoods depend on access to protein and fruit that they can gather in forests, they're the ones who suffer most.
Just one very interesting fact is that of the top 100 drugs sold commercially in the world today, 50% of those drugs are derived from compounds found in the wild. So it's not just animals, it's the diversity. We need to have a huge range of diversity if we're going to have the planet a healthy place, literally healthy in terms of human health, but healthy in terms of all the systems, economic systems that provide our way of life.
Yes, I think going back to what Zach called a blind spot amongst policymakers, do you think that translates to what the public are willing to accept or otherwise? Because so often we hear that when it comes to giving money to foreign countries, that it ought to be given to people rather than anything else. And how much of that messaging is failing right now?
Well, I think the politics around this is a bit messy. So there's historically always been skepticism about the very existence of the Department for International Development, the 0.7% commitment. That's, on the whole, surveys suggest that more people are opposed than in favour. That was compounded, I would say, by some of the recent scandals involving some of the development NGOs, which sort of confirmed a prejudice that some people already had. I say this, by the way, as a massive supporter of DFID and the 0.7%. I've defended it every day that I've been an MP. But what's interesting is that one of the main advocates for slashing back at that budget has been the Daily Mail. It's perennially returning to this issue. And yet they have provided front page after front page of supportive editorial when the government has committed to using some of those funds to dealing with issues like plastic in the oceans. So there is a market out there, politically, crudely speaking, there is a market out there among people and commentators for using some of this money to ensure that the world that we all depend on remains viable. And I think that's a huge promise there.
Thank you, Zach. Please come in, John, I guess.
So I just wanted to, just adding to what Zach was saying on the plastics front, I think we can hold that up as a place of optimism in terms of the response of the younger generation, the response of the British public, the response of even of corporates, and particularly the response of the microbead ban and so on, setting a really good example to other countries. We have not seen this kind of take up of an issue in a generation. Yeah. And I think the opportunity to build on that is now greater than it ever was.
And yes, referring to the sort of plastics issue, so much of that is sort of tangible and people, ordinary people, can stop using something or use something else. How can that be translated to the messaging around biodiversity?
Yeah, I think it's challenging. This is biodiversity's biggest problem, is it's complicated. But the truth is, we all know Britain has lost half of its own wildlife in the last 50 years. Mm. We all know what it takes to bring an appreciation of nature back into schools, into our daily lives, into practices, and into the way our government spends its money. I love the fact that we are now taking a sort of 25-year time frame, speaking again to what Peter was saying about these short-term political cycles. Mm. Well, looking at things over a long term means you can appreciate the sort of the depth of thought and investment that needs to go into resolving some of the conflicting issues. So the biggest problem with some of our trying to save some of the world's large mammals is the space issue. And inevitably, you get into questions about human-wildlife conflict and competition with infrastructure and so on. But these things done, there is enough space out there for animals and people to coexist. So it must be nature for humans and humans for nature. That's the only way we can move forward.
Can I put you on the spot a bit, Zach?
Yes.
You have been in the heart of government, and we know that people like Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, Richard Bennion, yourself, and many people on all sides of politics are deeply concerned about this extinction crisis. Mm-hmm. If you talk to them personally, what in your view are the barriers between getting that knowledge and understanding from those senior politicians into actual tangible political action and programmatic action?
So first of all, you're right that there are champions. I mean, I'm a backbencher, so I'm not in government, but I work very closely with government, and there are champions like people you mentioned, like Michael Gove, until recently Boris Johnson, he's not in government anymore, who have really been pushing these issues as hard as they possibly can. But fundamentally, you need leadership from the very top. I remember one of my first campaigns in Parliament was around the Blue Belt. You know, it was a huge campaign outside of Parliament, hundreds of thousands of people signing petitions, and as an MP I received endless letters. But in Parliament, Richard Bennion, myself, Oliver Letwin, we effectively had to knock on the door of Number 10 almost every week for a couple of years until that campaign finally succeeded. And as a result, we have that we now have committed as a government, as a country, to creating some of the world's biggest nature reserves around the world. Mm-hmm. That is something that has no material cost to voters, but it is something that is welcomed by voters. When you talk about it, people's eyes light up. They love the fact that Britain is doing something so positive around the world. But that only happened because at the end of the campaign, you had leadership at the top. And that's what we need. And I, to be absolutely honest with you, these issues we're talking about now are not a number one priority at the top of government at the moment, and they should be.
Yeah.
The issue of political will is massively important in African countries, for example. All it takes is a change of leadership at the top of the country, and that can have a massive effect on reducing corruption and improving the governance of protected areas, increasing funding for protected areas.
That's one of the issues that I think the ordinary people worry about, is that, you know, countries where ecosystems are most delicate have massive corruption problems. How can we sort of convince people that the funding will hit the areas it needs to?
If I can interject from my experience, when you go and try and run a biodiversity and habitat protection program in a country, there are many, many vested interests in there trying to get economic benefit. And I think it's a very important thing for us to do is we have a very valuable thing, which is money, and we have scientific skills, technical skills that we can bring to solve that problem. It's very important to keep the power in our hands to distribute those resources effectively and make sure that those resources are not seized by local vested interests. We need to work with local people to solve these problems, but we need to keep the power so that we can pick and choose where we allocate those resources, and that's the only way you get effective action. If you say here's 20 million pounds or 20 million euros to do this, that just disappears into the system, and we don't see effective action. We have often seen resources, you know, trucks stolen by people. You know, people are poor in those countries, and there's a lot of desire to accumulate those resources. So we need to keep the power in our hands and be very, very tough in the way we allocate resources.
Can I just come in there?
Yes, please.
I don't want to disagree, but I do want to disagree in a way, in that I don't disagree that we absolutely have to have complete control over these resources. But one of the ways we have found it works best is if you work with those communities directly on the ground.
I agree.
Actually, it's a route to democratization. You're working with people, you're empowering them to take control over their resources. They then hold their own government to account, so that corrupt officials are actually not tolerated. And it can be a very powerful mechanism for actually tackling corruption.
I want to add something. I mean, I strongly agree with that. I think if you look at the plans around elephant corridors or wildlife corridors, they can only work if the grassroots, if the local communities feel that they have a direct interest in preserving and maintaining those corridors. In other words, it's about creating livelihoods to de-link people, pull people out of the or serious organized crime that, for example, the illegal wildlife trade has become. There is always going to be corruption. There is no single policy for getting rid of corruption. It will always be there. So a bit that needs to be very much part of the discussion is around regulation. So there is a big campaign at the moment to get China, which imports two-thirds of all products from forests. Two-thirds of all forest products end up in China. The vast majority of that is from systems and countries and companies that are at best highly dubious. So the campaign is to try and get China to bring in a set of regulations that governs the quality of those forest products that are imported into China. If we succeed in that, and by the way, this is an area where Britain is doing an amazing job. No one talks about it, but this is a tiny pocket of work that DFID is doing, which it should be shouting from the rooftops. If it pulls it off, that is going to have a massive impact in countries all over the world, the DRC, Gabon, countries where even governments that have the will to tackle these problems nevertheless find themselves up against vested interests and unable to tackle those problems. But if you can deal with the demand, in other words, China, more than any other country, that has a massive ripple effect. So it's not just about sending in rangers, it's about creating alternative livelihoods, but it's also about better and cleaner and more effective regulation.
So is it about, on that sphere as well, making conservation more commercially convincing to big business in China? What's in it for them?
Well, China's obviously not a democracy. And so if the Chinese state gets serious with these issues, they can do so much more quickly than we can. I mean, they shocked the world by sort of pushing a button and closing down all the ivory carveries. They had 32 ivory factories all closed down pretty much overnight. We heard that they might do it. No one really expected they would, and they did it, and it happened very quickly. So they can move very quickly if they choose to police their borders more effectively, improve the sort of the barrier, the net through which products have to pass in order to enter the Chinese market. They can do that. It's a matter of political will. And we are seeing promising signs. China is the biggest problem today. There is no doubt about it. But it has the capacity to be the biggest part of the solution. It could do so very quickly. And if you take President Xi at his word, he's made some very, very profound statements in the last couple of years. So there is room for optimism, even in against the bleak context that we've all just provided you.
Can I just add to that? I think that there is that what we are seeing corporates really pick up this idea of performing to sustainable long-term profits, not just that short-term profits. We're seeing investors becoming more engaged. We're seeing the finance sector becoming more engaged. There is, with a bit of, I think, this idea of sort of really guiding the regulatory framework so that it really shapes the environment in which we all want to work, then there is no reason why you don't have a completely successful corporate sector alongside sustainable use of natural sources and restoration of natural ecosystems. But the problem is there are just a few too many bad guys out there at the moment. So one thing...
I want to bring Matthew in here.
Please. Yeah, although on that, we have more and more ways of seeing which producers in which supply chains, which commercial sectors are... more effective in reducing their impact on the environment than others. And investors can use those indices as a way of deciding which companies to invest in. And companies further down the supply chain can decide to source their palm oil, for example, from a company that has a good track record rather than one of the cowboys.
Just one point, and I know I'm slightly going back, but I think it's really important that we don't frame it as commerce versus the environment, because if you look at where you destroy the environment, there's a cost. I mean, no one doubts the link between the rise in piracy off the coast of Somalia with the destruction of that marine ecosystem. I mean, the day it was declared a dead zone was pretty much the day we saw the massive escalation, the mushrooming in the number of people who engaged in piracy. What is the cost of that in terms of world trade? What's the cost of that in terms of political stability in Somalia? There's a massive cost that's associated with it, in addition to the catastrophic biodiversity cost. And then the flip side is where you see ecological renewal, you see the impact on human communities. So, for example, there are forests in Vietnam which are in pristine conditions, paid for by the energy companies, the energy companies that have small hydro plants, and they know that if the forests are cut down, the rivers silt up and their hydro plants grind to a standstill and they lose their money. So they have a direct interest in paying to maintain those forests. It's good for business. Even in this country, in Britain, we're seeing water companies in Cornwall paying farmers not to put chemicals on the land because they're going to have to pay to clean out the chemicals later on further downstream. You've got water companies paying farmers to manage floodplains, to slow down the flow of water, to prevent the need for expensive concrete barriers downstream. That is where business has to go, a recognition that these things are so inextricably and fundamentally linked. We're a long way off. There are lots of examples like that, but it's so far away from being in the DNA of our businesses that we have an enormous amount of work to do. But that's where we have to go.
Can I just add on, sorry. You've also got opportunities in the commercial sector from things like innovative financial instruments. So our wonderful finance sector is producing a lot of really original ideas about how to bring financial markets into this conservation space successfully, but also in our tech sector. So the tech sector is also coming up with all sorts of innovations in the way in which we can do acoustic monitoring and things like that. So.
Okay, thank you. Peter?
Just very briefly, I used to run a £1 billion ethical investment company. And in brief terms, if governments set regulations, companies want to comply with those regulations, yeah. And good companies want to do it extremely well. Mm-hmm. I've got investments in Kenya, and we're trying to build a mine in Madagascar. If you say, do this, the company will do it gladly and to the very best of their ability, using management systems which actually deliver outcomes, training, and it's actually a way of increasing the skills base in many of these developing countries. Western companies with good governance and good technical skills can really raise the level of delivery of ecosystem services in these countries.
But also can help shape the regulatory frameworks of those countries.
Yeah.
So good corporate practice can actually help. So one of the biggest challenges of things like environmental impact assessment processes for big infrastructure projects, which is really creating issues in habitat disruption. And yet, if we can encourage the good guys to work with governments to actually set up systems that work, we can actually address that problem. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
One last thing, because on this one, I'll give you an example. So Indonesia has had some of the most destructive companies on earth, companies like Asian Pulp and Paper, probably the most destructive company on earth in terms of forestry. They were the subject of huge campaigns by Greenpeace, Rainforest Action Network, local campaign groups, and they felt the pressure to such an extent that they got around a table and they agreed a deal with Greenpeace. Within a couple of years, they went from being the bottom of the pile to the top of the pile. But the effect, so that was good for forests, but the effect of that was that they then became active lobbyists for a heightened regulatory system. They didn't want to be at a disadvantage. And Indonesia now is the only country in the world that is fully compliant with the new EU regulations on forest timber imports. It is not perfect. Clearly, lots of bad things still happening in Indonesia. But there has already been a measurable, marked impact in terms of a decrease in the destruction of virgin forests and important pristine habitat. That's the kind of stuff that I think we need to see globalized. Not the same set of regulations in every country, but the same principle applied in every country.
Okay, so we started this podcast by asking, whether or not we're facing an extinction crisis, and I think you've all been very clear that it's underway. Is it too late to turn back this tide?
No, I'm going to jump right in there. No, it's not. If you give nature half a chance, nature comes back very quickly. It's quite extraordinary. But the best example is World War II, when fishing was no longer possible in whole tracts of ocean, which had already been massively depleted, and the fish stocks came back very, very quickly. Marine protected areas, in fact, wherever they're introduced, incredibly popular now in Spain, even though the Spanish fishermen were the most sort of vehement opponents of the concept, they're now the biggest enthusiasts because it's improved their livelihoods. Give nature half a chance, nature comes back. But I think fundamentally, we need governments to ratchet up their enthusiasm around this agenda, not just by a few points, but by an order of magnitude. I go back to the point that Peter originally made. The easiest and most effective tool at our disposal in this country is our aid budget, $14.5 billion growing every year. We need to see a significant chunk of that money spent on restoring, repairing, and protecting ecosystems and nature with a view, not just to protecting nature, but alleviating and preventing base poverty. That has to be a goal of our department. And if every country with an aid department were to do the same thing, we would see things turn around pretty quickly, in my view.
And I mean, when you're on the doorstep talking to people, do you see this as a generational issue? Do young people care more? Should it be seen as a vote winner by the government?
I speak at schools all the time. It's just part of my job. And I don't think I've ever done a speech at a school where the majority of questions haven't in one way or another been associated with the stuff we're talking about now. It might be very local, a local green or a park. It might be litter in Richmond Park. It might be the whale that was found a few years ago in the River Thames full of plastic. It might be the looming extinction of a big cat species. It always comes up. Young people are totally, totally engaged with this issue.
So it should be a vote winner.
I think it is. I'm not sure how many people vote for parties on the basis of their being good on these issues. But I think a party that's not good on this issue disqualifies itself as being taken seriously as a party. So it may not be the number one issue, but if you ask 10 people, what are your top concerns? If they haven't got a home, they'll say shelter. If they haven't got a job, they'll say employment. If they're feeling ill, they'll say NHS. Or if they've got a member of their family, it depends on it. But that is not to say that this isn't an overriding issue or even a filter through which voters look at and judge political parties. I hope that's true, because if it's not real trouble.
Okay, we haven't got long left, so I'm talking of filters through which everything is being viewed. Brexit.
Yeah.
If we accept that stopping extinction will require cross-border cooperation between countries, won't Brexit compromise our ability to protect global nature? Peter?
I don't think so. I think Brexit offers us a wonderful opportunity to get some resources to apply to this problem. Britain sends £1.5 billion to the European Union as part of its ODA spend. Let's get that £1.5 billion and let's apply it to nature. It's a very clear opportunity there. We don't have to take it away from any existing programs that we've got. It's money that we can use as part of, dare I say it, the Brexit dividend. And when we do get that money, I believe that we should set up an agency, a global biodiversity agency that works around the world to solve this problem. And an agency can be a wonderful thing. I think of NASA, where a really big, audacious target was set, and you form a core of people who are determined to achieve that outcome over a very long term, a period of time, and work following a culture gets built, and that achievement, that objective is ultimately achieved through that resourcing. It's a big, audacious idea, but I think that is really a big part of it. And it allows us to use British skills, and it will be a huge boost for the British scientific community, the British aid community, and working on biodiversity.
Thank you. John, what's your view on Brexit and global nature?
For me, it is. I'm not going to agree or disagree with Peter's idea of a new institution. That wasn't kind of on my radar screen, but what is very much this idea of British leadership. I think the opportunity to be leaders back in this space, to reclaim the moral high ground and the effectiveness high ground of actually being out there, bringing resources to bear, bringing expertise to bear, using the fantastic academic and civil society organisations that Britain has and that we can champion globally to help create a really balanced playing field, working with local partner organisations and building capacity. I think that leadership and capacity building between them is a wonderful opportunity.
Thank you, Matthew.
And actually, I think one of the areas where the UK already leads the world is in the degree of awareness of these issues in the general public. If one were to rank certainly the countries around the world that I've lived in, I think the UK would be number one in terms of public awareness of the threats to biodiversity.
Yeah.
Blue Planet, which was, I think, one of the most recent vehicles through which the public learned about plastics in the oceans, was a British, was based on British expertise, British knowledge, and has been exported around the world in a way that I think most of us would love to see after Brexit.
So if there's such a huge awareness, why is action so lacking? We come back to that.
I'm going to first add to that. So I think it's true. We are world leaders in marine protected areas, in terms of protecting the marine environment, standing up for it. We're world leaders in terms of the illegal wildlife trade. We've got about 85 countries represented at a conference just in a couple of weeks' time in London, the fourth conference, the second one that we've organised. So we are already doing some important work, and we are world leaders, but I don't want to pretend that we're doing enough. If we need 100 units of action, we're probably seeing 2 or 3 units at the moment. But as it happens, a lot of, a big chunk of those 2 or 3 units are emanating from the United Kingdom. So there are some things which should make us proud, but we need to do much, much more. In terms of the sort of Brexit opportunities, I very much agree with a lot of what Peter's just said. There's another direct opportunity, and that's domestically. We spend £4 billion a year subsidising people for owning land, no matter what they do to that land. They could trash that land, they still get the subsidies. We're changing that, turning it on its head, so that that money will only be given to landowners who manage their land responsibly from a biodiversity point of view, from a flood management point of view, from a public good point of view. We'll be the first country in Europe to do that, and I think it will transform. I think it'll reverse, in fact, the declines that we've seen in this country. It's the biggest environmental story we've had in this country for generations, and that's a huge opportunity that is only possible because of Brexit. So there are lots of reasons why Brexit will be good for the environment. Equally, there are lots of challenges which we're going to have to overcome.
So the doom and gloom that we've been reading with various scientific warnings, it's not too late, is that the bottom line? But there's lots to do.
We're getting pretty blooming close, but it's too late for the species we've already lost. It's too late for the habitats that have been wiped out. It's too late for the people whose livelihoods have just been pulled out from under them as a result of this kind of irresponsible behaviour. But it's not too late to save the planet and to turn the tide.
But we must act on climate change, which is going to affect every human on the planet, every animal on the planet. The time for action on that is right now.
And prevention of loss is going to be a lot cheaper than restoration, which is the only alternative strategy that we have.
Thank you.
Claire, just one final thing is we have to look at the context of the extinction crisis. It is fundamentally caused by a massive growth in human population and human consumption. If you look at the world's population, it is now, the United Nations is forecasting that it's going to go to 11 billion from where we are at about 7.6, 7.7 billion at the moment. And our GDP, our global economy, which sits on top of this environment, is going to be about 100 times as big as it was in 1950 by 2100. So the burden we are placing on our planet is about 100 times what it was only 70 years ago. So we are consuming at 4 times the sustainable rate. So that's the really big issue that has to be confronted. How do we get this planet into balance between the human economy and the natural environment? If you counted up all and weighed all the wild terrestrial mammals in the world, only 3% of them are wild. 97% of them are in the human economy. And 45% of them are cattle. So that's a system wildly out of balance. And if you go and kill millions of elephants and rhinos and bison and so on, that's the outcome. So people have no idea. 3% of all terrestrial mammals are wild. It's a very, very tiny number.
So we can't just rely on governments. It has to... people need to take individual responsibility.
No, I believe fundamentally it comes down to government action. If you want systemic change, you need government action. And government resources.
There's almost nothing that needs to be done that isn't already being done somewhere in the world. It's just not all happening under one umbrella. You know, there are huge, large-scale agricultural economies that are sustainable. There are energy systems that are sustainable. It would be possible for the governments tomorrow to say no more single-use plastics. There's absolutely no economic downside or quality of life downside to humanity, to removing from the system things which have no place in a long-term sustainable future.
I think on the plastics, we feel like it is going in that direction.
We are moving in that direction. But that's just one example. But this is true across the board. Yep. There's fishing. You know, there are fishing nets that are 4 times bigger than the O2. That they are not compatible with a sustainable future, and they're wiping out fish stocks. They're not good on any level at all. We shouldn't be using them. But there are alternatives that exist which are sustainable. So there is an answer to almost every one of the problems. The thing that's lacking is political will. And yes, you're going to have some companies doing wonderful things, but you're going to have a lot of companies doing really bad things, which is why you do need government intervention. You can't just leave it to the free market. This is a blind spot. This is market failure on a catastrophic scale. And the only way to correct market failure is actually to bring in smart, intelligent, forensic, surgical regulations. It's the only way to do it.
Okay, we'll have to leave it there. That's all we've got time for.
Thank you.
Thank you very much all for
coming
in.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Behind the Story podcast. If you want to get in touch to share your thoughts, you can reach us on Twitter @HigginsonTweets. We hope you'll subscribe and join us next time.